first question, a technical question. Can you see the limiter? It's like with the eyes open. It's possible, but it's rare. And the only way it usually happens, if you really get some strong meditation and your mind is very, very powerful and your five senses are very subdued, then you can even see the light, the limiter, with your eyes open. What is happening is your five senses are usually so much energized, much more than the mind. So you give most attention to seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. So their amplitude, their strength is up here, and the mind is usually down here. You can't really sort of perceive it that well. But when you come on a meditation retreat and you calm down your five senses, you don't go looking around so much, and you now subdue the hearing, well, people want to say whatever they want to say, you don't really listen to it, your smell and taste, that's very easy to subdue, and you relax your body, so the body's not doing very much. So the five senses get very, very calm down. And all that energy goes into the mind, so it becomes more and more strong. And when it gets to the even place, then that's usually when you can start to see the limiters in your mind. The five senses haven't totally stopped yet when you see the limiter in your mind, but they're just so weak. If you do hear a sound like 1,000 miles away, that's what it feels like. And, you know, that if you feel a feeling in the body, you can't hardly feel it anyway. So it's usually the five senses have been so subdued, and that's usually where the limiter appears. Now, it's not the case that the five senses are totally gone yet. They're just really subdued, and the mind is strengthened up. And it's also the case, I haven't said yet, is that when you are a really kind, good person, that also puts energy into your mind, what we call a pure-hearted person. And we all know people like that, they never complain, and they're always there to help and look after, really generous, really kind, trustworthy people, you know, the really good-hearted people. Now, because they've been practicing like that for a long time, or just their mind is naturally very powerful, so that they don't have to subdue their five senses that much to see a beautiful light come up in the mind. I always know a few people like that. They're the ones, you know, I say, oh, these are really kind, good people, always serving, volunteering, sacrificing their own happiness for other people. Those are people really pure-hearted, dependable. And those are the ones that really get strong limiters once the five senses get subdued. So, it doesn't matter anyway, that still you can always put some more energy into your mind. Inspiration, energy, kindness, just that after a while that limiter sort of pops up. That's what you usually see it with your eyes closed. But if it really gets into it, that limiter, the mind gets so empowered, really, really strong, that even with your eyes open, you've just got this light in front of you. That's only after you've had a lot of really deep meditations. So you have to eat your lunch through a light. It's not a big light then, just put it through. It's a bit disturbing, but you know, it's just beautiful. Then, whenever you want, even just close your eyes and just get in deep meditation again. It's a sign your mind is really powerful. So that's one of the possibilities there. It's possible, but it's unlikely. Very rare. But when it is, well, just go for it. You're having great fun. And it's also that you can understand what we said today about things like psychic powers and stuff. They do exist. But, you know, you need to get such a powerful mind to be able to do tricks like that. And you don't do it to show off. That's why then you just keep it quiet and calm. And they're very, you know, very sensitive as well. You know, if the five senses really get inflamed, of course you lose those powers. And it's like one of my favorite stories of the monk who was in the forest. I did tell this the last few days ago. Who could levitate. So he was off in a very remote part of the countryside, and in a forest by himself, a really good monk, keeping all the precepts, living so simply, and just meditating, just nature, that after a while get some very deep meditation, and then could actually levitate. Now the problem was that someone saw him, you know, going through a circuit. And when they saw him, people can't keep their mouths shut. They actually go and tell. You know, there's a monk in that forest, they can levitate. And so the villagers saw it, the townspeople saw it, and eventually it got to the king of the country. And the king always wanted, you know, to see someone who could levitate. So he sent one of his ministers off on the journey into the forest and asked the monk, "His Royal Highness summoned you to come and, you know, show him some levitation." And I'm like, forget about it, I'm not interested. I'm happy here in my simple life. I don't want to sort of go out with kings and mess around with all these wealthy, rich people. I'm just a simple monk. So he wouldn't go. So the king, next time, sent one regiment of the army to make, you know, what one of those films I saw before I became a monk was The Godfather, to make him an offer he couldn't refuse. So this poor monk had to go into the city, but the king was a kind Buddhist, so he built him a forest in the middle of the royal gardens. And in the middle of the forest he put a little monk's hut for him to meditate in. And I was always interested in that story because many years ago when I was in Thailand, it was one of the quite amazing Thai monks came to visit here. So about 4 or 5 months later, when he heard I was in Bangkok, he invited me to come and visit him. And he was staying in a hut in about 1 acre of forest in Chitlada Palace, where King Bhumibol used to live, His Royal Highness of Thailand. And the King of Thailand built that little area because he wanted to retire and to be a monk and practice meditation. But, you know, his plans never came to fruition for many reasons. But he actually had this in the middle of Chitlada Palace, in the middle of Bangkok, you know, in the big gardens, had a big forest there, and a monk's hut, so simple. And so this, it's Ajahn Lien, he was the monk who was staying there, so they invited me. It's interesting to actually see what was happening there. So anyway, the same thing happened to this monk a long time ago. So he was installed in this little hut, in a little forest, in the gardens. And then, this was about hundreds of years ago. And the king would feed him, you know, whatever food he needed from the royal kitchens. And that every now and again the king needed some inspiration, you know, just some advice, or just, you know, just to boost him up with some kindness, he would go and visit the monk. And the monk, the rest of the day, was just free to meditate and just have a live a simple life. Now the problem came when one day the monk was levitating around the palace, just a bit of exercise. And the king, he was busy that morning, so he sent one of his daughters, this really beautiful princess. I mean, really drop dead gorgeous. Really a hot chick. I don't know why you laugh when monks say that, but it always works. It's just modern language, I listen to what people say. So anyway, he was just levitating around, flying through the air, and he saw this really beautiful woman, and he had one moment of desire. One moment, that's all it took, and he lost his ability to fly. He did crash landing. and so bruised that, you know, he took the food. He's not a good man, he didn't disrobe or anything. He took his food and realised it's not a good place to live in a palace if you're a monk. Too many temptations. So, after his meal, he packed his stuff up and he couldn't fly anymore. He had to walk all the way back to the forest. And once he got back, it took him another couple of years before he could actually get his ability to fly again. So that's how sensitive the psychic powers are. So if ever you do learn how to fly, be careful, because going up is easy, coming down might be a bit dangerous if you can't control and restrain your senses. So I always like that story. But yes, you do feel after a while, and you get some really powers in there, and that's what happens. Limiters show you've got a powerful mind. If a person keeps on turn his or her face away from you for whatever reason, if you're always kind and love him or her, what should we do? Oh, the person keeps his or her face away from you for whatever reason. What should you do? Still take initiative to approach him or her. Hopefully one day he or she will respond. Just be passive and give only a smiling face. Just ignore, like you said, brain problem. Understand, whatever way, we should not have anger inside of us. Yeah, of course. If people don't want to look at us, they're smart. What do they want to look at you for? I don't know why they want to look at me. If you really want them to see you, take a selfie of them and email it to them. So it might be that sometimes people do that as saying they're upset with you, or they don't like you, or something or other. But, you know, if there's a reason for that, you know, you've cheated them, or you've let them down, or whatever. I don't know what it might be. So, I know that sometimes I turn my face away from people when I tell this particular story. Because this was the story of like trying to encourage questions from people. And it was a story from the, I think it's the Chulakamavibhanga Sutta, where this man came to see the Buddha and asked him a series of questions. And the first question was, why is it, you know, that some people are rich and other people are poor? And something doesn't matter about intelligence or hard work. Some people are really smart and they work so hard and they just find it so difficult to, you know, to get by. Or, you know, they get some money and then someone cheats them or they lose it all and all. Now, but other people, they don't do anything and they just, money comes to them. There must be some karma from the past. And the Buddha gave a good answer about how to be rich in your next life. And the second question was, why is it that some people are beautiful and other people are just ugly? Doesn't matter how many hairdos, breast implants, Botox treatments, facelifts you have, you know, you're still not attractive. And it's at that time I always put my head down. I don't look at anybody. Because it happened, it was in Singapore this occurred. I haven't been telling that story. You see why I tell the story when you get to the next series of questions. That I told that story and I just happened, you know, to be looking at one woman when I said the word ugly. My goodness, did she complain. Ajahn Brahm, why did you say the word ugly when you were looking at me? What's wrong with you? I got in big trouble for that. So now I always put my head down. But even more so, to teach the other monks, I'm an old monk now, even when you say the word beautiful, just put your head down. Don't look at a girl. Even don't look at a guy either, you get, you know, misunderstood. So that's why I do turn my head away. But the reason to tell that story, Buddha gave a nice a reason why people are born beautiful, not ugly. Another reason for being beautiful in this life, and some people born ugly. If you're beautiful, you're always like kind, and you keep precepts, you're a good person. Virtue is beauty. So if you're a virtuous person, then next life you'll be beautiful. And if you're always angry and stingy and forthright, that makes you ugly in your next life. Yes, that's a fair. So, you look at an ugly person, or an angry person, sorry, if you get angry, look at yourself, you're ugly, you're like a monster. So, if you get angry a lot in this life, you know, you get stuck like that. You know, your face gets stuck like monster face. That's who you are in the next life, ugly. And to be wealthy, they say, always be generous. It's almost like that money is not just to be enjoyed for yourself. It's to be shared, make some good karma. It's almost like you're entrusted with this power to help others. And if you don't use it properly, you just use it to waste it with, you know, just trying to prove just how wealthy you are, just to show off. But instead you actually share it out with people. It's like enlightened, that person knows how to use wealth. So you get entrusted with some more in your next life. Instead of just keeping it for yourself. So, that is why sometimes I turn my... The last question is, why are some people born intelligent? And it doesn't matter, just you don't have to do extra studies, you don't need to have tutors, and some of your kids are just passing exams so easily. And no, that wasn't me. I never sort of had to worry about passing exams. I just breeze through them, no problem, no worries at all. And you don't say this person, but why are some people so stupid? You see them working so hard, doing homework, studying, and they still don't get good marks. And the reason, according to the Buddha, was if you don't ask questions in this life, you'll be stupid in your next life. It's not asking questions. That's the cause of stupidity. You ask questions, it's the cause of intelligence. It's like inquiry. So you've got this wonderful mind which is always asking questions, challenging. But when you ask that question, it develops intelligence. So that's always quite like that. And it's always, whenever I give a talk and you can't get any question because people are, you know, a bit embarrassed about asking questions, I say that, you know, if you don't ask a question, you'll be stupid in the next life. It's amazing how many questions I get. Anyway, there's the saying that we choose our parents on life map when we were in before life form. Is it true? In that case, we should know what will happen in life events when we choose our parents in this world. Thanks. Well, if you chose your parents, some of you made a very bad choice. Some make a very good choice. So it's not like we choose like with a free will. It's very much conditioned. You know, where we feel, you know, we want to be born. And I often quote one of my disciples, an Australian Caucasian, and I asked him, where do you want to be reborn in your next life? A very good person. No kind, generous, no virtuous. And he said, in my next life, I want to be reborn as a dog. What do you want to be reborn as a dog for? I said, well, look, think about it. Be intelligent, I said, well. A dog does not need to go to work on a Monday morning. A dog doesn't have all these problems with balancing the books and people cheating you or investing on the stock market. The dog has no worries at all. He just sleeps all day and gets fed amazing food. And I wouldn't believe them. Dogs don't eat dog food anymore. They eat some chickens and steaks and wheat. It's amazing just how people in Australia, what they feed their dogs. And they don't just sleep out in the streets. They've got these amazing kennels. And sometimes they've got air conditioning in the kennels. You have to check it out. So dogs, good food, they get free health care. They don't have to pay the bills. You know, their parents do, they get free. And all the responsibility they have to do, it's just when they get patted to wag their tail. That's all. And they take their owner out for a walk in the morning. It's not you don't take the dog out for a walk. The dog takes you out for a walk. So, stress-free life. Lots of sleep, nice warm house or cool kennel, whatever you want to go. So, and the dog has maids. You, the owner. look at it, I mean, if you look after that dog so much, it's like you're the mate, you're the servant. Slave, yeah, slave of the dog or the cat. Yeah, so, you know, the dog's got a bit of intelligence, hasn't it? It knows how to get all the, what it wants without any stress at all. So he had a point there. Until I reminded him, because I knew this character, I said, if you're a dog, say born in, say, Australia, then your first months of life, you have to be taken to the vet to get de-sexed. And as soon as I told him that, his face went down and said, I don't want to be a dog. But, you know, sometimes we make choices which are ill-informed. We want to be like this, we want to be like that. And one of the most ill-informed ones, you want to be really rich and powerful. And famous. Who wants to be famous? So, that's the wrong choice, because we think, oh, it'd be great to be really rich and famous, and that's just so much of a pain. So many worries. The wise people, just in the middle, somewhere, they're the best. So that, yeah, we do choose our pearls and life map, but obviously a lot of times with no real wisdom. After I finished my meditation in Bodhinyana, I smell a strong flavour. It's like flower flavour, but I cannot find a flower, and I feel joy and happy even though I can't find a flower. So would you be willing to explain experience, please? Yeah, that's very common. But I already mentioned that when you get nice and peaceful, your mindfulness increases in power. You know, you see the your food tastes more delicious. You know, the wooden floor, you can see more in it, looks more beautiful. And even smells which are already here are much more fragrant. Your mindfulness notices more. It's always here, but you can't notice it because you're not mindful enough, and the mindfulness sees whatever it sees is so beautiful. That's one of the marvellous things about mindfulness and meditation. When you're really still, oh, you just go outside and see a leaf on the tree, and it's incredibly gorgeous. And there's the stars at night, they're just amazing. But if you're busy and you get sort of distracted and you're tired, you go out and see those stars, they're not as beautiful anymore. It's the beauty is not in the stars. The beauty is not in the food. The beauty is not in the flower. It's actually just you're so mindful, so powerful that you see joy in everything. That's why the breath becomes delightful. The breath is just the breath. But your mindfulness is so strong, whatever you see is gorgeous. Whatever you smell is fragrant. So that's what happens. It's not the devas, you know, in the hall here congratulating you on your deep meditation. All it is just the nature of the smell which is always there. What you perceive becomes gorgeous and beautiful. So it's fragrant. It's a wonderful thing to know that, because even people who are your enemies, you see them and they're beautiful because you've got strong mindfulness. Such strong mindfulness, everything looks delightful. And that's great fun to have that. Nothing can upset you. Everything is gorgeous in this world. As soon as we arrived at Jhana Grove, the happiness approaching us, the cottages are five-star accommodation, the groves are beautiful, the two stupas are spiritual atmosphere. We may not be too silent, but those are expression of our happy to be with you, our great Ajahn, the three Indonesian group. Places do have power, which is amazing to know. So the more we practice meditation there, the more we are kind, not fault-finding. It doesn't matter that you make a noise. If you didn't make the noise, something else would make a noise. So you're totally forgiven and loved and cared for and welcome to come back again. You're not blacklisted, don't worry. And the cottages are five-star accommodation. They're comfortable. They're not really five-star. They haven't got TVs and internet and stuff. But they're simple and nice. They're comfortable, I hope, for you. And why? Because you deserve it. Just, we talk about kindness and compassion, and if I can't be kind and compassionate to you by giving you nice accommodation, then I'm a hypocrite. And it is a happy place. It just builds up atmosphere. When I went over to, on a pilgrimage once, going through Kathmandu, just, yeah, I don't know why they take us to these places, I just want to see the Buddhist sites. But the plane landed there, so I went to the old palaces, and I remember getting bored, being a bit rebellious. Instead of following the tour guide, you know, I went, there's an interesting passage, I wonder where this leads. And when I went inside there, I never felt such negative, dark energy before. That was really sort of bleh. And I couldn't understand why that was such a bad place. You could feel it sensitive. You want to get out as soon as possible. So I asked the guide, you know, what the heck was that place? He said, oh, that was the place where when they had the kings in Nepal, they would do their annual ritual slaughtering of the animals in that little courtyard there. And I never knew that. There's no signs there. But you just go in there, really felt it. That's a really bad place. Because of all the suffering which had gone on there. And instead of that, there was this English girl, I think some of you may have seen her, know her, said her husband was the Buddhist, but she just came along to be with her husband. No, English, no, quite sort of old, in her early 70s. And they wanted to go on a pilgrimage to India, so they came on a pilgrimage, and I was leading it. I can't do that anymore, just, you know, getting too old and too busy. I can do more important things, better use of my resource. But that time I led a pilgrimage and did a little orientation meeting first of all, just know what to do, how to do it, what to expect. And one of the things I said there was that some of those places you'll go to in India, where the Buddha actually lived, where he sat meditation, and they're not commercialized, you just go there and you can sit down where the Buddha sat down. And said some of them have just got incredible power. I mean, really powerful stuff. And some of you haven't had nice meditation before, you go there and, whoa, you're going to just really fly. I mean, not literally, but I mean, just... And this woman, she never told me at the time, she thought, what a lot of gomaya, no bullshit. She'd been to England and gone to all these castles, and they were just old monuments. That's all it was, these old monuments and ruins in India. What is she talking about, energy? But she was the one, the first night she came to ask forgiveness of me. She says, I thought you're absolutely stupid and wrong, but this is what happened. She went into the Mahabodhi temple, you know, in Bodh Gaya, and as soon as she walked in, not expecting this to happen, she wept. She couldn't stop. Was that a good accent, weeping? Some say yes, I better stick to my job as a monk and not join the theatre. But she wept and wept and wept and wept, and she couldn't believe why. And just the energy got to her, totally unexpected. And so there you are. That's what happens. Sometimes places, they do have some energy, and you just get dragged away with it. And hopefully that some of you have spent, you know, half an hour meditating in the hall of Bodhinyana at the front. That's got huge energy in there. And even, I wasn't there at the time, but one of the people, they brought a Feng Shui master to Perth, and they just took him inside the hall, and he got blown away by that energy. This hall's got incredible Feng Shui. At the back, not so much. At the front, huge. And hopefully you've done that, you've gone in there, a bit restless here, sleepy, but you go over there, it's worth the walk, sit in the front. Wow. It's got some huge energy there. So people who get restless or they can't really focus, you go there and it's just easy. So you do have places which have energy. I'll probably all go over there tomorrow now. If you go in there, in that place anyway, please don't talk. because that is a special place over there. Anyway, so you build up the happiness. So even this garden grove, is you come in here and you feel peaceful. And even we had one of these people who wasn't a Buddhist, he worked for the local council, the Serpentine Jarrowdale Council. And he came up to me after lunch one day and said, "Thank you." I said, "For what?" He said, "Thank you for your car park." And I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "I've been the building surveyor in this council for the last 8 or 9 years. Tomorrow I'm retiring, finishing. I've got to my retirement age. But I want to thank you because every time I got stressed out at work, I just got in my car and I came into your car park and I just parked. I just need to be there for half an hour, all my stress, you know, the stress of work, dealing with builders who, you know, wanted their license, and they're done now, today, doing all that stress, he just came there and he just totally just relaxed." And so he never told me he was doing that, he said, "Just thank you for having a car park where I could just come." Saved a lot of money with psychologists and psychiatrists and lawyers, but I just come there, just the energy just got to me. So that's why, yeah, this is a happy place, peaceful place. Kindly elaborate on the mind and consciousness in the context of meditation and dying. Okay. It's, look upon it, six types of consciousness. Seeing is a type of consciousness, but it's totally different than smelling, than hearing, than tasting, and touching. But there's something similar to it. And what's similar to it? Whenever you see something, then it's registered in the mind. The mind knows it. The mind knows you see. Whenever you hear something, then the mind knows you heard. So that gives something very similar to these five senses. But once you understand what the mind really is, you can actually understand that these are totally different senses. And when you meditate, you calm down these five external senses until they disappear. And the only one left is the mind, which is incredibly powerful. And also, in the context of dying, once you can subdue the five senses temporarily and just have just the mind sense, you know, and I've already mentioned that when you get into the deep meditation, you can't feel the body, you can't hear sounds. Those five senses have been so subdued, they're not there anymore. And that has very strong similarities to dying, which is actually what happens when you die. The five senses, which depend upon the brain, just slowly stop. And your mind takes over. So the brain becomes dysfunctional, and the mind takes over the job. And that's why it's really so much evidence around about people that have been in a coma, and just before they're about to pass away, they wake up and they see people. Like, two of the girls in Perth told me that one was a Buddhist, the other one not, but their dad was dying, two sisters, and they were just next to the hospital bed, just holding their father's hands. He was in a coma for days, just waiting for that last breath to go out and the next breath not to go in. And I've been there, just sometimes you just don't know when it's going to happen. And sometimes, you know your loved one, they just, and that's it. And then they breathe in again. And you're all quirky, it's another hour, I'm going to stay here. Yeah, I'm a mark, okay, I'm just there to support the family. I haven't got the emotional bond. But they were waiting for that moment, and then without, totally unexpected, they were holding his hand, and he opened his eyes, and he bent up. He'd been in a coma for days, and looked at his two daughters, and without any planning, absolutely synchronous, they both said, "We love you, Dad." And then he fell back and died. Just, the mind sometimes takes, well, the mind always takes over the last few minutes, or the last few seconds. The brain stops, and then the mind sort of takes over. I've been teaching that. Doctors always come and give me more information, their experiences. And only recently, about 6 months ago, this doctor came up and said, yeah, it happened. He was a registrar or something, just, I forget the actual right term. But he got a message from the nurse, one of his patients, the dying process had begun much earlier than the doctor expected. And the process had begun, the guy was dying. So he quickly ran to her bedside and checked, the nurse was absolutely correct, he started the dying process. And so he frantically, tried to call the relations to get to the hospital quickly. Your father, your uncle, your brother is dying now. And so they had a little address book in the drawer, so he was calling one after the other as fast as he could. This is serious, he's only got a few minutes to go. Get her here as soon as you can. Unexpected. And he was calling the guy's daughter. Just say it's June or something, because that's the month today. So he called June, you've got to get to the hospital quick. Your father is dying. Come. And then he opened his eyes and said, I told you how much I love her. And then he passed away. He'd been again a coma for a long time, but he woke up just those last few minutes. And that's so common. The brain is now dysfunctional and the mind takes over and does these amazing little things. So that's actually quite beautiful when that happens, if you're lucky enough to be there and they remember everything, even people with dementia. They haven't recognised you for months. And suddenly they just open their eyes and say, oh, Peter, how are you? I've been coming every day for years. And then that's a sign they're going to pass away any moment now. The mind takes over. Quite beautiful. One of my friends, I think I told the story, too many stories. That was Ted. He was a fellow who would smoke and he got lung cancer. So I know the family really well. So I went off to he was put in the hospice, where you go to die. And when he went to the I like this story, it's really funny. Because, this guy was English, from Lancashire, very traditional. And I can really relate to him, some of the things he said, as probably I might say too. But he, in the hospice, no cures, just palliative care, just to make sure that he's going to be comfortable. And maybe 6 or 7 days, he expected to die of his lung cancer. And the nurse came up to him and said, what do you want for your dinner this evening, Ted? And that's when he said, look, I've got high cholesterol, so I can't have anything oily. Diabetes as well, so nothing sugary or sweet. Hardened arteries, so no salt, please. And he went on like this, and the nurse looked at him and said, Ted, what on earth are you talking about? You won't die from cholesterol. You won't die from diabetes or heart and arteries. You've got cancer. That's going to kill you. You can eat whatever you want. And his eyes went wide. He said, you mean all those favorite foods that my wife would never let me eat, I can eat?
Yes.
So he ordered the most greasy, cholesterol-enhanced, diabetically strengthened foods with heaps of salt. And he was enjoying himself so much, after 6 days, he walked out of that hospice on his own legs and he recovered. He had an extra 6 months. And then he went back and died properly. But it was just, even Shakespeare said that, man doesn't live by bread alone. It's not just your food, it's your energy, your happiness, your joy. And that's a bit of a rebellious because people are very concerned about what they eat, but also be concerned about what you enjoy as well, your happiness as well. He gave Ted an extra 6 months, but when he did pass away, I was there by his bedside for most of the time. And his last words, if you're an English person, you'd understand this so well. You know, sitting there, supporting the family, you know, just it's taken so long to die. At any moment he could die, but it was getting close to my lunchtime. So the only thing to do was to send out for some fast food. I think it was chicken treat or something, which was just some chicken and chips with gravy. And that's all he could get. And so because his daughter was very English as well, his son-in-law too was a very strong English, so we all had ham and chips. And there's a custom, you know, which I grew up with. If you're having some chips, you ask them, do you want a chip? And that was what his daughter said to her dad. Dad, do you want a chip? And he opened his eyes and said, yeah. And that was his last words before he I was there, I saw it, it was true. Because it was something which actually drew him out of his stupor. Yeah, I'll have a chip. And then he passed away. Sorry?
He was dying for a chip.
You're blacklisted, man. Exactly. But funny stories. But he came out just the last moment. Anyway, what is your view for us to pursue PhD in Buddhism after getting a master's degree? You know what PhD stands for? What does it stand for? Permanent head damage. Sometimes it's good to get a PhD if you're really interested in that. But it's hard work. And if you do get a PhD in Buddhism, you know, it gives you some cred. So you can go out and just teach or teach other people. Even, you know, it's actually a master's in theoretical physics. It does give you some credibility as a monk, even. So, you know, you're not just an airhead, you know, you've got some brains. So, you know, have to get their brains to go to Cambridge with theoretical physics. But what it meant was that it did give you some credibility, even though I've forgotten most of it now. But nevertheless, it gives you some credibility. But don't just study the thing. Ajahn Chah said, study and practice. The practice of, you know, keeping your virtue and just being generous, being forgiving, being kind, developing meditation. So that is like the main course of your meal. That is like the curry and rice if you're Asian, the potatoes and the chips and the fish if you're English. That is just the main course. And the study, he said, is the dessert, the sweet. And if all you eat is dessert, you know, the sweets, you know, the puddings and the ice cream, that's all you ever eat, you're going to get very sick. So, yeah, it's important to do some study, but don't just do study, because otherwise, without the practice, you don't really understand it. If you can forget about not wanting for 1 second, what would be your deathbed wish? A chip. If you could forget about not wanting for 1 second, what would be your deathbed wish? Would you like to come back again in your next life as Ajahn? Oh, come on. Give me a break. Now, when you're on your deathbed, you know, you've done all your jobs. You know, just don't worry about your loved ones and your friends. Just, they've been looking after them for such a long time. They look after themselves. And so, your wish to just remember about, you know, all the good things you've done in your life. Don't just worry about all the bad things. Oh, I shouldn't have done this. Oh, I shouldn't have done that. Remember all the good things in your life. Bring yourself some happiness and joy up. And also just remember your meditation. Let go. Open the door of your heart to whatever's happening in this moment. Make peace with this dying process. You get so relaxed and so peaceful. Who knows, it might totally disappear. So that's how you die. Just how you learn how to meditate. But if you can't be calm and peaceful now, you know, when you're alive, sitting in a nice comfortable room in a 5-star meditation retreat centre, it's very difficult to imagine you can be peaceful with all the turmoil of the dying process. So you practice now. This is learning how to die. I'll be honest with you, learning how to let go. Learning how to let your 5 senses go, no fear, just peace. And it's actually a very pleasant experience. So you don't have to worry about anything. Doing it is easy. Dying, thinking about it is the hard part. Just like that story of pushing the wheelbarrows. So that's the deathbed wish. How to determine whether it's useful or unuseful speech? You're telling our life story, speaking about our problems. How do you determine that? Look in the face of the person you're talking to. And if they're going, then you're talking too much. So, you get feedback from people. So, that's how you determine it's useful or unuseful speech. Okay, another little story. One of the first times I went to Indonesia, this is wonderful General Punyawara, you know him. He lives over in Medan. Wihara Mendut. Next to Dr. Carter. So when I went to visit him, he gave me a VIP tour. He still says that, told me that that book, The Art of Disappearing, is his favourite book, you know, about meditation. So he was really praising that book, The Art of Disappearing. But when I was there, he invited me to stay overnight there. So he took me to Borobudur Temple, just gave me the real tour. It's great when you get someone who really knows what they're talking about. And it was here we got some sponsorship for those 2 stupas outside there. They're from the same stone, the lava stone at Borobudur. And he asked me, he said, how big do you want them? Because I think he also presented some to the monastery in England. And they're sort of 10% bigger than what's at Borobudur. And I said, well, I can't get bigger than that estimator. That's just, you know, just too much pride. So make it 108%. So it's just 8% bigger, because 108 is a really good number. So they're that 1.08% the size of those you see over in the real ones over in Georgia. And he also, that's where he also told me just the significance of those stupas. And why there were so many Hindus and Muslims and Christians climbing up to the very top and putting their hand inside the top. You know that, don't you?
Yeah.
If I catch any of you doing that, I'm going to tell your husband. If you see any monks doing that, you tell me. Because the myth is, this is a tradition, that if you could put your hand inside and touch the Buddha, then you will find true love.
Oh.
I'm watching you. Be careful. So Sally, if you see Mike doing that, snap him one, you got my permission. So just got a little fun. But anyway. So that's where those stupas come from. But anyway, on his Mendut temple, the Vihara Mendut, that's very old as well, there was a carving there. And there was a carving of one of my favourite stories in the Jataka, the talkative tortoise. The two tortoises. Haven't you been there? Next time you go there, two swans with a stick and a tortoise fighting onto the middle. And they can't get there. And so he would laugh. He'd say, yeah, your story, it's in there. It's on Vihara Mendel, on the Chedia. So anyway, that was a great one to tell your kids. There was a talkative tortoise who lived up in the mountains next to a lake. And the talkative tortoise had hardly any friends, because as soon as he started talking, he would not shut up. He'd talk for hours and hours and hours. You know people like that. You can't get in a word in edgewise. And so every time the rabbit saw that talkative tortoise run away into his hole, because once he got caught in a conversation, could not escape. And the tortoise, even the fishes, they would hide, because they get really caught. This talkative tortoise would never ever stop. And because of that, he had no friends, was really lonely. You talk too much, you don't have any friends. So you've got to listen as well as talking. So anyway, he had two friends who were just so incredibly kind and patient. And those were two swans who would fly up into the mountains during the really hot weather. You know how hot it is in Jakarta, or even in Hong Kong during the really hot time of the year. They'd fly up into the mountains because it was nice and cool in there, and swim on the lake. And they'd always listen to talkative tortoise who went on and on and on to the time at night time, and even the stars ran out of twinkle, they'd still be talking. But the swans were kind, they listened, they realised he had no other friends. And so when the hot weather stopped and it was getting colder and colder up in the mountains, summer was changing to autumn and even winter, the swan said they'd have to go now. And talkative says, oh, please don't go, I can't stand it without you, because you're so kind and I really love you and you're so patient, you understand me, so please don't go, because I don't want you to go, because I don't know, I'm a talkative tortoise, I really appreciate your company. Half an hour later when he stopped talking, the swan said, well, I know that being a tortoise you can't walk very fast. So that's one of the reasons you can't just walk down the mountainside, because by the time you get down there, it'll be time to come back up again. Tortoises always walk slowly. They said, we can take you with us, as long as you promise one thing. And the tortoise said, I promise, we tortoises always keep our promises, and we can promise anything, because we are so trustworthy. We tortoises are famous for our trustworthiness. We won't say and do anything wrong. Whatever you say, we'll accept it. And then they told him what he had to do. Very simple, keep your mouth shut. That's easy, well, I can keep my mouth shut, no problem at all. I always keep my mouth shut. In fact, I'm very well trained to keep my mouth shut. Be tortoises always keep them. And so the two swans got a stick. One swan held a stick in one's beak, and the other swan in the other, in his beak. And they told the tortoise to bite on in the middle. And the two swans flapped their wings harder and harder and harder. And what do you think happened? Nothing. Tortoise was too heavy. Because people who talk a lot are usually very fat. So they had to get a lighter stick. And then with the tortoise holding onto the middle, they flapped harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. Harder than they'd ever flapped before, because out of compassion. And eventually they could lift off, carrying the stick, and with the stick, the tortoise. The tortoise was flying. The first time in history a tortoise ever flew. And that was Dr. Carter. At least that's where there's carving used. And he was flying over the mountains. You know, the first time you go in an aircraft, it's amazing. You see, your home becomes so small and tiny as you go higher and higher and higher. And the tortoise was trying to remember everything of this amazing experience so he can tell his friends when he gets back. And they were flying, they got down over to the city, from the mountains. Just at the time, their children were coming out of the school. And one of the children just happened to look up into the sky. What do you think he saw? He pointed out, hey, look at that stupid tortoise flying. And the tortoise said, who are you calling stupid? Oops. And when it was the time he should keep his mouth shut, he couldn't resist it. And down he went, down, down, and splat. And he became hamburger patty. And that was... that was caused because he had no training in keeping his mouth shut. And so when it was really important he kept his mouth shut, he couldn't do it. And that's what happened to him. The talkative tortoise died. And I know there's a lawyer, here's a lawyer joke. Because what I was saying today about the super meditation, going to see autopsies. Now some of you may know of a man called Bhante Gunaratana. You know, he's written many books. He lives over in Virginia. And anyway, he gave a talk to his American disciples about the benefits of going to see an autopsy. You know, you get some understanding of where the body is, so you don't get so worried about bodies getting old or, you know, hot chicks and, you know, really sort of great guys, Richard Gere, whatever you like. But after a while, you know, they said, well, this is a wonderful way to get rid of the attachment to the body. See an autopsy, see what it really is like. So how do they get to an autopsy? It's very difficult, especially in the United States. So a whole group of them, they went to the local hospital. They literally stood outside the mortuary where the autopsy was being done. You know, the coroner's office, I think it's called. And they asked, now, can we go in? We won't say anything. We'll just, you know, stand around there and just to look. It's our religious practice. Come on. They said, absolutely no, it's illegal. You can't do it. So they argued and argued, and eventually they gave up, except for one of them. One of them decided to stick around. Maybe if there's so many people, they wouldn't allow them in, but one person, maybe they would. And so he waited for someone to come out, and he said who he was, and he wanted just to go inside. And the guy said, no, you can't do that. And anyway, don't bother me, I'm just really stressed out because, you know, I'm going through a divorce. And that, this disciple of Ajahn, of Bhante, said, you're going through a divorce, I'm a divorce lawyer. I can actually do the papers for you for free, if you let me in. Because, you know, lawyers cost a lot of money. You know, and he said, well, you know, just, if I sneak you in, and keep quiet, and you'll do my legal papers for you. He said, yeah. So, you know, he had the papers there, and the lawyer was helping him fill it in, saving a lot of money, a lot of time. And then he sneaked him into the autopsy room. And so there was, you know, this lawyer, you know, in the green clothes, now pretending to be just some doctor or some medical assistant. And they had this African-American fellow, and they were giving an autopsy. They didn't know why he died. So that's the idea of an autopsy, to find out the cause of death. And as they were looking at him, they said, wow, he's a real piece of work. In other words, he had many operations. And then eventually, just one of the doctors said, yeah, that's it. And it was something in Latin. And this lawyer couldn't keep his mouth shut. He said, oh, cancer. It didn't mean cancer at all. Everybody stopped. They looked at him. They realized he wasn't a doctor, because that meant malpractice. It was a mistake. And they said, who are you? He said, I'm a lawyer. Ah! Get out of here! Because they could have sued the hospital for billions. So he couldn't keep his mouth shut. Just like talkative tortoise. So I read that in this little magazine about trying to see autopsies. So if you do, if you don't see an autopsy, don't take a lawyer. Or if you are a lawyer, just keep your mouth shut. Bye. Anyway, please explain the difference between intention and wanting. Is there, if there is any, also between mind and consciousness? Mind and consciousness, I was saying already. But the intention and wanting. Wanting. This is law, and it's also the Afinaya. Make the difference between motivation and intention. Intention is the goal of your action, where you're trying to get to. Motivation is where you're coming from. You know, you might sort of shout at somebody, but why? The motivation is, you know, there's a car coming, get out of the way quickly. So you're shouting at a person, but your motivation is to save their life. So it's not that monks don't shout. If I saw you about to step on a snake, I'd shout, "Hey, look out, snake!" Monks aren't supposed to shout, are they? I would, if it's saved your life. It's motivation. The intention is actually where you're going to with that. So wanting, if you have an intention, it has to be wanting something. So that's why, to let go of wanting, the motivation of just renounce, basically to stop all of this stuff and be still. If none of this is mine, who gets enlightened? The path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Enlightenment is, but not a person who enters it. That was on one of the sutta classes from Visuddhi Magga. No one gets enlightened or achieves enlightenment. You disappear, you vanish. So, you're gone. So that's, you disappear. All your attributes, everything which you ever thought you were, just vanishes. Poof, and you disappear. So it's not an attainment, it's a letting go, a disappearance, a great vanishing act. That's why when the Buddha passed away, no one could find it. It's gone. Disappeared. Oh, that's really cute. Anyway, that's the answer to that. Not a person gets enlightened. There's nobody here anyway. It's just the five components of existence, your body. That's just stuff. Even as a physicist, there's nothing there. You go into the body. Okay, you can see bones and blood and stuff, but that's just, what's it called, cells. You go into the cells and there's just, you know, proteins. You get into a protein, it's just, compounds. You go into the compounds, it's just atoms. You go into the atom, even the atom, you know, just, there's a lot of stuff there. It's just so little stuff. It's just the electron, proton, neutron. The spaces between them are so huge. It's like 99.9999999. I don't know how many nines, I forget now. I'm about 120 or something of nothing. It's a tiny little bit of electron. Other than that, it's just space. Nothing there. And you get a proton. You know, the actual stuff in this atom, which is, you know, just basically nothing there. You have a look at that. And then there's nothing there either. It's just a few forces which give the image of solidity. Well, even now, remember these little particles called neutrinos coming from the sun. There's millions passing through you right now. You can't feel them because to them you're totally invisible. You've got more space in you than stuff. So people say, you know, maybe you're 70% water, but no, you're 99.9999999999. Big going all illegally. Nothing. Space. And it's great when you get your head around that. And even that's you and this planet Earth and the spaces between the planets is huge. This universe is just basically just nothing. It's empty. It's a tiny little spots. And on those spots, it's basically nothing, and then there's you. And in you, there's just absolutely nothing. Just, that's so close to truth. The amount of stuff there is just so small. So, you don't get annihilated. You just disappear. Could you please tell us a story of when the PSW celebrated his birthday, and that there was a heavy storm and it didn't rain until the event finished? That's a supernatural story. I'll leave that to the very last. When we do the meditation, how can we smell the incense or flowers? What are the meaning of that, and what should I do? Smell the incense and the flowers. I think I answered that, maybe. I think you mean that, you know, you get these fragrant smells when you meditate. Not in the room. No, we don't like incense in here, because actually it was when I went to an autopsy. Now I just asked. I think the person was dying of the cancer, lung cancer, because he'd been smoking all his life. I said, what's the difference between cigarettes and incense? He said, smoke is smoke is smoke. Even incense is bad for your health. Oh, wow, that's really interesting. Because we have so many temples with lots and lots of incense. No, I don't know, maybe you can actually correct me on that. But it's not really healthy having so much incense. That's why here we don't have incense. Just the offerings to a Buddha, just offering your practice, your kindness, your goodness. Don't need incense. But anyway, the flowers, they're not that bad unless you have hay fever. That's why I have classic flowers here. Because, you know, I suffer from hay fever. Because my father had asthma. I don't have asthma, but you've got some genes there which you get hay fever sometimes. So, it's really awful, my karma, that, you know, that being a man, that people don't offer men flowers unless you're a monk. So, and I have to sit closest to the flowers. So, okay. So they give you some plastic ones, or paper ones. They last a long time and they don't make you sneeze. So anyway, the incense and the flowers, the main offering you can give is your kindness, your practice. That's the best one. And so that's, how can we smell the incense? It's not real incense, you just, your senses become so powerful. You can actually smell beautiful flavors. So lastly, the story of when the BSWA, Buddhist Society of West Australia, celebrated its 30th birthday. How many of you were there then? Anyone who were here? Ah, Burles. So you can correct me if there's any mistakes or exaggerations. 30th anniversary of our Buddhist community here in Perth. And the president of that time, it was actually Sol, when he started being president. He said, 30, we should do something, you know, to celebrate our birthday. I thought, yeah, really good idea. And he wanted to do something in the South Perth foreshore. I said, oh, come on, let's do it big. You're going to do something, give it everything you've got. And so, now, let's try, where did the central field in Perth, Supreme Court Gardens, let's do it there. Ah, it'll probably be already booked. So he checked out, it was Waitsak Day, the full moon day, and it was on a Sunday. And it was free that day. So we booked it. And I told the president and the treasurer, don't worry about expense. When you do something inspiring, the money comes in. And so, let's go for broke. So, we just, no expense spared. Hired all the marquees and we got a new Buddha statue from Thailand also, you know, to be the centre of the event. Planned it all out, invited all these VIPs, including at that time the Premier of Western Australia, and that was Jeff Gallop. And as a result of that, he's a patron of Jhana Grove. He came to its opening here because he really got impressed. So much hard work. And as you know, I'm not a lazy monk. I actually, when I organize something, I really get into it. Just also work really, really hard. So I got all the invitations out, a program, getting everybody, you know, ambassadors as well. Everyone to come, all the VIPs, you know, let people know what's happening. The TV, radio, just go through the whole thing. And Sunday morning on that waste that day, I got up and it was raining. It was an open air ceremony. It was raining. And so we checked the weather forecast. It rang out. And we didn't get that professor we got a real meteorologist and he said, yeah, no, there's going to be a storm coming. There was a weather event, they called it. And yeah, you do get that in Perth every now and again. And the storm is going to hit at 7 p.m. Hit Perth. And there's a warning, you know, to take your, put all any loose things away, tie them down, make sure your gutters are clean because there's going to be a really heavy storm coming. It's going to hit right when the Premier was expected to arrive and give the speech and all the circumambulation around the new Buddha statue. So, what do you do? Cancel? No way. Three times. Now the premier doesn't call, his secretary does. Three times they called me. It's on one of the people's mobile phones. And the premier wants to talk to you. He said, are you cancelling? No. A couple of hours later, look, the weather forecast, are you cancelling? No. Third time, are you cancelling? No way. And I'm very stubborn. And there was this fellow Brian, and he passed away some time ago, but he said he was a sailor, merchant navy. He said, you know, he sailed all his life. And he said, Ajahn Brahm, listen, I know what I'm talking about. A storm is coming. He saw the barometer, he checked it every hour. It was going down, low pressure, trough was coming. There was going to be a really heavy storm. The TV was reporting it, the radio was reporting it. He said, you have to cancel. And it was raining all the time. I got soaked to the skin. All the other people got soaked to the skin. I was so proud of them. I just kept on going. And I had some leadership skills there. And I said, come on, keep on going. This is special. This is Waisak Day, the Buddha's birthday, enlightenment, and just passing away there. This is special. And then one of my monks came up, grabbed me by the shoulder and took me aside. He said, Ajahn Brahm, so look, I'm your disciple, but sometimes you go too far. We're getting embarrassed, you know, that we trust you. But it's a storm. You've got to stop and cancel. It's not going to work. And I said, no. That was Chris. Remember, he's a monk at the time. So he confirms that. And so I just kept on going, raining heavier and heavier and heavier. And I remember just being in a VIP tent, just arranging the chairs. And Sherry's mother, Shirley Jackson, she came into the tent crying her eyes out. And my first thought was, what's gone wrong now? Has someone had an accident or something? What else can go wrong? And she was crying and said, come outside, come outside. And when I went outside, the rain had stopped. But even more than that, the clouds had parted and she saw the full disc of the full moon in the night sky. Even I thought it was quiet of that. Just almost like a miracle was there. It stopped raining and the moon was out, the full moon of Waisak, when it shouldn't be there at all. And half an hour later the premier came, there was a Thai ambassador came there as well. And as a result of that, you know, she told the people in Thailand to make me Chalkun. That's why I became Chalkun. She made that happen. And there was a TV crew there. And they kept following me around. And the interviewer kept on saying, this is weird. This is weird. This is weird. They couldn't believe it. Then it stopped raining. And we came there, we did our ceremony. There was a light shower, maybe about a minute or something, very light. But we did our whole ceremony, including the circumambulation with the premier and with the ambassador and the VIPs. And as soon as the ceremony was over, then it poured down. And that field was flooded, the freeway was closed, very heavy flood. But we managed to do the whole ceremony. And Ajahn Bhamali, you know, you know him, he's given talks. He's got two MAs, one in business, one in electrical engineering. I always call him Mama Bhamali. Mama Bhamali. But, you know, he's a skeptic. And he said, that's one thing I saw my own eyes, that should not have happened. That was some supernatural thing. He asked him, he said, that's one of the things, yeah, I have to concede, Ajahn Brahm, yes, that was something weird. And the following day, I think, the person who organized the tents got an email from the head of the company, it's Reese Hire, RWEC, a big company, also does plumbing. And she showed me the email. which read, I had never heard of this Ajahn Brahm. I don't know who he is. Can you please ask him who's going to win the horse racing today? No, it's like a compliment, you know, that something weird was going on. We never got many people actually coming as expected. And when I asked people afterwards, why didn't you come? You know, these are key people of our Buddhist society. You held a ceremony? Yeah. Where we lived, which was the west, the east, the north and south of Perth, trees were falling down. It really was a big storm. And they couldn't believe that we did the ceremony and there was no rain. And that's why they never came. So, couldn't believe it, you did it. We did it there. And that premier at the time, when we came to open this place, he said, can you come and just be our patron? So I said, yeah, sure. So he came and became a very good friend. He was also, unfortunately, he had a depression, so he quit his job. But it was a big shame that he quit, because he was a good friend, but also he had influence, and I had influence over him. The next plan, he was the best man at Tony Blair's wedding, because they went to Oxford together. They were really close friends. So now I had Jeff. It was only just one step to convert Tony and Sherry to Buddhism. And then I would have George W. Bush. So close, so close. And that would really be supernatural. But never mind, never mind. But that's the truth. You know, stop the rain. And it was that people say, oh yeah, you stopped the rain, but that was a storm. That was really weird. That was really impressive. Why do you do that? It's because it's not just Ajahn Brahm, it's not just the monks, it's because of an important occasion. And if you're doing something really, really important, a lot of faith, lots of energy, lots of goodness, so many people are just giving so much, of course, the powers in this world will help. And they did. So that's 30th anniversary. Sadhu! 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 Was that about right? Did I hit anything or exaggerate anything?
No.
That's about right, your experience too?